Good evening, I'm Bob and I'm an alcoholic. For the grace of God and the power of AA, I haven't had a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. In some places that'll be a lot of sobriety, but I'm not sure it's a lot of sobriety after last night. That was very cool, having the amount of sobriety in the room that was in the room. One of the things, I started talking when I was in the womb, I have very good form. I don't have much content is the problem. And this has been a special weekend for all sorts of reasons. I am very admiring of this event. I find it very attractive. I want to know what the hell is going on and what the hell I want. I thought it was an Al-Anon movement or something. I always thought Al-Anons were very supportive until I got in my wife's closet the other day and found this little doll that looked an awful lot like me with all these pins in it. That's a joke. I have that. That is as far away from what I believe about Alan. This has been a wonderful weekend. First of all, the city may be the most beautiful city, certainly in North America, if not in the world. It is one of the most. I just don't know where you get the combination of forest and mountains and ocean and lack of pollution and got a big enough place to make a living and all the wonderful things that you have. It is just extraordinary. And I have many old friends here, one of whom, Jack Ford, is one of the guys I admire the most in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have met. I had the pleasure of serving with Jack as delegate in 1979. You just form friendship. As you go through life, you just run into people who you connect with, and Jack with one of those people that, and Molly later that I connected with, and then you really find out Molly's much nicer than Jack, and it's like people usually discover about Linda and I, but it's been a great relationship, and it's every time I get a chance to get together with Jack, it's very special. But I love the amount of sobriety. I also there are so many conventions that I attend where people don't dress very nicely anymore. I think this crowd is a very attractive group of people. I do. I mean that. And it's much easier to tell the boys from the girls at this conference than it has been at almost any conference. I don't think I got mixed up almost at all today. But it's nice. I really like it when our fellowship represents so much. And there are so many wonderful things. And I really like it when you walk into a group and what you see is attractive. And what I see when I walk into this group is attractive. I like your organization. I think it's very nice having two people over 50 years of sobriety and quite a number of people, through their 40 years of sobriety and through 30. One of the things that thrilled me about going to conferences when I was young is that they had, I just wanted to hang out with the big guys, And I was at a conference last year where I was the longest sober person, and it was just the worst damn feeling in the world. I think when you're young in sobriety, you think, boy, that'd be cool someday. And maybe if I ever live and have the joy of being 50 years sober or as long as my sponsor, that would be cool. But it isn't cool now. I don't like that. It is, I've always been an admirer of the old timer. My sponsor got 45 years, and we're still close. And I really like it when I see the people. It's such a challenge to maintain a lifetime relationship with anything: marriages, parenting, cities, jobs. And sometimes we forget that when you have even a relationship with our recovery, and even a relationship with the fellowship. I mean, it's extraordinary that people have maintained that relationship intact, with integrity and with energy, for the 20 and 30 and 40 and sometimes 50 years. That is not a small accomplishment. There are so many bumps along the way that, you know, when you're, so I admire and I enjoy the fact that we have people. I enjoyed John very much last night. I'm sorry that I'm not going to be here tomorrow for Dawn and for Sister Maurice. I've heard them both. They are wonderful. You did a great job. I'm leaving on a trip on a Wednesday, and I have to get back to my area to do a couple of things. Now I should probably give an AA talk. The last thing I want to say, as wonderful as this weekend has been, I have had the sorriest host. You'd think with a class event like this that they would give you someone who would help and be friendly and make things easier, and it just hasn't been the case almost at all. There's just been one difficulty after another, but you learn to deal with those things as you get sober. And so I mean, Bill looks nice, you know, but it's been hard, and it's nice being here with my wife. Linda, would you stand up, please? I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school. I went to a military academy on a college campus. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities, and we drank our brains out. I'm also born and raised in a Catholic enclave, and I think Catholics drink a lot. I don't know if they drink. They drink a lot. And I never knew that we may drink more than other denominations, but if we have a contest, I'm going with my group. But when I entered high school, I was 4'11" and weighed 95 pounds. And it was all mouth. It was, I was one of those insecure kids. My mom and dad had 7 kids, and I think mom started sending the older ones to school the moment she could. So I was one of the youngest kids in my class, so I was small. I didn't reach puberty until I was almost 30. And, so I was always trying to catch up and compensate. And so I would, always trying to get attention, big mouth, all those sorts of things. And I always felt like everybody else got to school an hour early, held a meeting, and decided what to do for the day, and I always missed the meeting. And everybody else knew, but I didn't know, so I'd say, hell of a meeting, huh? Hoping you'd talk about the meeting. And you never did, and I always felt a little insecure. And, that insecurity that we all talk about. My mother always said, Bob, you're not very bright. Dress well. And I have, I've always tried to do that. My mother has a sharp tongue, so she, I took her out to lunch the day before I left. My mother is 87 years old. College graduate, not a person you want to irritate. And, interesting lady. So, one night a friend of mine went out and brought a fifth one night. We went out and we split that fifth, and my life changed. I mean, I started to feel on the inside like I thought everybody else felt on the outside. It was just marvelous. I mean, it just brought a sense of ease and comfort with me, and all of a sudden I was able to mix and talk to girls and be funny, and, I showed up at a party full of seniors at my sister's house, our house that my sister was having. And if I would have showed up at that party sober, I would have been shining shoes for the rest of my life at my school, but for some reason it worked. I could just make things work when I drank, as John talked about. I just, it just changed things. And from that moment on, I became a social drinker. Anytime anybody else said, I'll have a drink, I said, so shall I. I just never passed up an opportunity to do it. And we drank a lot. I was at my, 5 closest friends in high school, 4 of us are in AA and 1's in Al-Anon. And of my class of 128 guys, there are 13 members of AA that I know of. So, while we had a lot of alcoholism, we were blessed with a lot of recovery. I mean, I think that's extraordinary to have, 12 members of AA from a group that's small. A couple of us almost died of alcohol poisoning. They talk about, you see that happening today with kids in college, I don't know the term for it, and I can't think of what it is, but, we did it all. We just, we were sophomore year, we were drinking stout beer out of straws and cans because we thought you got high quicker, you know, when you drink it out of a, just dumb crap, you know, but we, by the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home, and I didn't think I had a drinking problem. Everybody in my family did, except me. It's just screwy when you're underage. If you drink a lot, you get, you know, it doesn't matter if you have one drink or 15 drinks. If the police catch you or your father catches you, you are in deep doo-doo. And I was trying to, you know, we were acting like we were grown-ups. My father was one of those Second World War guys that came back and made life look, they just made life look easy. They worked hard, played hard, had big families, started businesses. They were just attractive men and women. They were just, you know, and as I say, I grew up in this Catholic enclave. Everybody had between 6 and 12 children. If you had less than 6, you probably lost about 4. I mean, it was just wonderful. And when you were friends of one clan, you know, and it still is true, you walk around, you know, and you're friends of families because the children were, and ran a range of about 15 years, and once you were friends of one of the kids, you just had the benefits. So I still live in the town I was born in, and it's fun to walk around and run into people that you went to school with. But when I went away, you know, I thought, you know, if I was allowed to drink like an adult, my drinking had become normal. But what the hell? Why get in trouble for having one drink? You know, that never made sense to me, you know. So at least if I'm going to get caught, I'm going to have a good time. Went away to college. My drinking did not become normal. To make a long story short, I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I walked out in the middle of my senior year, in the yearbook, with my class ring. Dumb. Just dumb, you know. I saw that movie Rudy not too long ago, and I'd seen it before, but it just struck me at how much he got out of that experience of going to that school and how little I got. I wasn't conscious at all during that period of time. I was the class drunk. I had 3 guys petition to have me removed from the engineering school. I mean, I literally was the class drunk, and I won't get into it, but it was just not a great experience. When I left, I was due to be commissioned. I had to get a medical release, or I would have been drafted as a private. And while I was sick, I was not stupid. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. And that seemed inappropriate, seemed goofy, didn't seem possible. You know, I can remember, my family, you know, was just, didn't know what to do with me. Just absolutely didn't. My brother was Phi Beta Kappa at law school. My sister was did her graduate work at the Sorbonne in Paris, and I'm this slob in between. You know, I just not doing it. And they brought me to a psychiatrist finally. He diagnosed me as an alcoholic. I remember going to the library, and I got a book on alcoholism, and it was Freudian-based, and it said that alcoholism was related to latent homosexuality. This is not good news for a young, insecure guy. I mean, I may have been able to look at one issue at a time, but looking at that issue and alcoholism at the same time was too much for me. We shut that book. You know, I was not that. And then they referred me to a psychiatrist at Notre Dame, a woman's psychiatrist, and that was the first question she asked me if I was gay. And I was just not up for, you know, look at her, all that. And I couldn't, you know, so it didn't seem possible to me that a 19-year-old was an alcoholic. But it got me out of the service. I came home, finished school at a local university. When I finished school, my father asked me to leave the house. He said, "We love you and we care about you, but you're a pain in the ass. Goodbye." And I got a job at a liquor store. And have to use your gifts. If you're going to make it in life, you have to use your gifts. I got a job at a liquor store. Almost killed a little girl one morning in that truck driving drunk, making deliveries. Thank God she wasn't hurt. I lost that job for going 80 miles an hour, getting a ticket. I went over and worked as a waiter. This is the last year of my drinking. I worked as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis. I lived 6 miles from I was sharing an apartment in St. Paul. I think in the 6 months I worked as a waiter, I made it home about 6 nights. I get up in the morning, drink a couple of beers, take a Dextrin, go to work. Work from 11 to 2 as a waiter. At 2 o'clock, I go drink beer at a bar. At 5, I go buy a half pint or a pint, put it in my jacket. And somewhere during that day, I'd figure out where I was going to sleep. I slept around with waiters and waitresses and different... You know Dr. Seuss, that child author? Those are actual photographs of people I live with during that It was not a good time. It was a hard time. And I went to a party one night, and I got my face kicked in, and they fired me. They didn't want me serving food, looking the way I looked, and I had no place to go. I was tapped. I hadn't been home for 2 or 3 months, and I went back to my family, and I asked my father if I could move back in the house, and Dad said, yeah, if you don't drink. So I promised I wouldn't drink. I lied, but I promised I wouldn't drink. Alcoholism meant a lot of, you know, different things to me, but one of the things it meant is about every 6 months I had to start my life over. I mean, you know, everybody in this room who has the problem knows an awful lot about starting over. We know some less about finishing, but we know an awful lot about starting over. I didn't want to be the problem that I was. I think I wanted for me much what my mom and dad wanted for me. I just didn't know how to get it. Every time I tried to start over and have it be a different year at school or a different year at work or something different, it was different for a week or a day or a month, but it wasn't different very long. And pretty soon I'm back to my old pattern, and it's as mysterious to me as it was to them. Why I was trashing everything that was valuable to them and valuable to myself, I had no idea. It was as painful to me, I'm sure, if not more painful than it was for my parents to watch it. Being the parent of 3 kids who are in the program, I can report to you that I know that there is pain involved with. I've turned my wife in as a carrier and to New York, and they have done nothing about it. That's a joke. There's no one. They're really protective of you, Linda. I think that's very nice. But when I moved back in the house, I made maybe the largest full court press of putting my act together. It occurred to me that if I could put certain things into my life, I could order my life. If I found a woman that I loved, she loved me, and I got married, I get some structure. And so I've been going with Linda for a couple of years, and we broke up, and then we became, and I got back together, best thing that ever happened to me. Linda's has been active in Al-Anon for 32 years, and that has been... I don't think we'd be married today if that were not the case. And it is so wonderful to have a partner in recovery. It is so wonderful to have someone that when you're in serious conflict that they're able to look at their part and you can... No, I'm serious. Because if you don't, if you can't look at yourself, you turn the lasers on each other. And if you don't take the lasers off each other soon enough, you can really hurt each other. And that has been, each of us having a way to take our own responsibility in situations has given enough space for our love to remain strong over these years, and it's been a great deal. So I got back together with Linda, we got engaged and married, got a job as an executive trainee with a manufacturing concern, bought my first car. I thought, wow, I'm out of here. This is going to be okay. I could not shut my drinking down. Now I'm the company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers. I use up my sick leave the first 2 months. I'm falling asleep at my desk. It's just, I mean, you laugh, but big corporations are tough places for alcoholics. They have like to have you come in on Mondays and stay on Fridays and they have lunch hours, and it wasn't working out. And I quit that job after, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, just before I'm sure going to be let go, and I took a job as a salesperson thinking that it would give me more flexibility, and I hadn't. And I was into that job about 3 months, and one of my friends got married, and weddings were always bad. They were about a week-long obligation to get drunk. And I remember that I woke up Thursday afternoon sometime in July of 1967, and I hadn't been to work that week. And I called in a couple of days and hadn't called in the next couple of days, and I woke up not knowing if I had a fiance, a job, or a place to live until I was married, because I hadn't been home in 3 or 4 days. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem so dumb that day, and I called AA. I had an old-timer at the central office. He talked to me for a little bit, asked me if I could go meet a couple of guys at a cafe in about an hour and a half, and I said that I couldn't. He described them, And I went over, and that afternoon, about 5:30 in the afternoon on a Thursday, I went over and met 2 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was scared stiff. I thought they were going to interview me. When you're young and in trouble and you've been around to a lot of doctors and psychiatrists and lawyers and judges and stuff, you're always being interviewed. And I thought, and I'm pretty young, and I thought these 2 guys were going to interview me. And I went there. One guy had 6 years, one guy had 6 months. and thank God they were active members of AA and knew what their message was, and they didn't interview me. They said they were there as much for themselves as they were for me. If they had a drinking problem, they found an answer in AA, and they found that talking to other people to try to help them stay sober. And those two men changed my life by sharing their life with me. We have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most wonderful of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our thinking. We don't get so ideological, we don't get too intellectual about it. There is something very special about sharing the wisdom that we have through our experience. It makes it much more pithy and much more touchable and much more accessible. And I found myself identifying with these men. Those were the first two men I'd ever talked to who had a drinking problem. I talked to an awful lot of people who tried to help me, never had talked to another person. The conversation was total. Those men changed my life. That night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was extraordinary. I drank twice after going to my first meeting of AA, once on a business trip after 30 days of sobriety when I went out to California, and I was told to call AA and didn't. I won't get into that, but I got in trouble. And then I was sober almost 3 months, and we got married. And I think in the back of my mind, I had always planned to drink on my honeymoon. It just made sense. I think I complied on the surface, but I think I really did have this thing planned, but not. I wasn't a conscious sort of thing, I don't think. And we honeymooned in Mexico. You know where the divers dive off those cliffs in Mexico? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest, Linda and I thought, God, that's not so tough, you know. I mean, I could do that, you know. And I went over and introduced myself to the ex-president of Mexico. He was there. His nephew had been my roommate at my sophomore year at Notre Dame. He was not impressed. His bodyguard, I'm just slobbering drunk. So I had a swimsuit on underneath my shorts. I stripped down. I went down to the public line, dove off the cliff, started to climb up the cliff. Linda's going absolutely nuts. She's trying to get the police to get me down. I get up about 85 or 90 feet. I get stuck. I split my swimsuit. I cut my leg, and I'm stuck. I'm up there, you know. You know, you can't climb down. I don't know if you ever climb up a cliff. Climbing down a cliff, impossible. So I'm up there watching the waves coming in and out, and I'm watching. I'm trying to figure out whether to dive or jump. You know, I'm just looking at it. And finally I figured out the hell with it, and I dove. And God watches after fools and drunks, because I made it. Now, that's not as high as a diver's dive, but it's high enough to kill yourself. Norm Alpey was an old-time speaker from California that talked in AA. And he talked about seconds and inches. If it were not for seconds and inches, this room would be empty. For the car accidents and for the crimes and for the illnesses and the different, the way we, you know, many of us have had brushes with death. But for seconds, had I jumped, I would have died. I did not know that. You can't get out far. You have to get out about 30 feet, and you can't get out far enough if you jump. I didn't know that. It was just like flip a coin. Ten years later, Linda and I are down there with the kids on vacation, and we're on the balcony watching the divers, and she had given me a card on my 10th AA anniversary that said, "There but for the grace of God," and it showed the chasm of the, you know. And I said, "God, honey, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10. How you can share a life with someone and experience it so differently. You know, just little communication. Now that I've gotten older, I've gained a little weight. I'm trying to get in shape. I thought maybe I'd, you know, buy a bike. She thought that was a good idea. I bought a bike. She got upset. I bought a Harley. And try to please her. You know, it gets more difficult all the time. And so I had my last drink on the airplane on the way home. Now I'm 24 years old by a week, and I'm sober. Thank God I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was worried about going there. Linda said, "Go to the meeting." So I went to the meeting, checked in with my sponsor. And at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and over the next couple of months, I made a discovery which was to change my life. You told me that alcoholism was a disease, physical, also mental and spiritual. I was told that alcoholism was a disease, that once I crossed the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, that my alcoholism affected me all the time. When I was drinking and when I was not drinking. That was, I mean, I just I had never heard that anyplace. I thought alcoholism affected you when you were intoxicated. It never occurred to me that alcoholism would affect you when you were sober. Some of the worst problems, I mean, I thought people, you know, when they said I was an alcoholic, I thought they didn't get it. Some of the worst behavior, some of the worst thinking, some of the worst experiences I had cold stone sober. You know, and I could not relate them to swallowing bourbon. I thought when you were telling me I was an alcoholic, you were telling me that most of the problems and the issues of my life were related to swallowing bourbon, and I had a problem tying all those things together. But I remember my sponsor told me, he said, I think the physical part's 10%. I remember how shocked I was. 10% of the deal. He said, yeah, what we do in AA, and once we get sober, is we use the 12 steps to change. To change sufficiently to find something better so that we don't have to go back to drugs or alcohol to do something for us that we're unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. And if we don't change, we're going to go back to drinking because we don't know how to live without it. Profound. Just absolutely profound. I mean, I remember being shy. I thought that we would spend considerable time in meetings talking about how not to drink. And you know, that isn't much of a conversation, and strangely enough, not much of a conversation. We talk about how to live in a way so that we don't go back to drinking. I remember how confused I was. We were talking about, you know, all these guys paying bills and making amends, and they got a fight with their wife or trouble at work, and the conversations had so little to do with drinking. And when I was new, that surprised me. You know, pretty quickly I kind of, you know, caught on about it, but when I was new, that was a surprise. So I'm 24 years old. I'm sober. I'm in this group. I got a sponsor who is the most, his name's Warren. He's sober 45 years. And a great guy. Still a very active member of AA. And he was a champion 12-stepper of our group. He got probably a third of all the 12-step calls in our group. And when I started to tag along with him, I got to go on those calls, and it was just marvelous. And I just kind of followed Warren around and started to copy what he did. As a result of copying what he did, I copied him into service. I copied him into giving AA talks. I copied him into sponsorship. And it just could not have had a better leader for me in my recovery than that man. But I can remember how excited I was, because I was a guy who was frustrated by being such a horse's rear end. Okay, I didn't like supposedly being reasonably well equipped to live my life and not being able to live it. I didn't like being the problem of our family. I didn't like, my mother never liked me in jail. it was little things, you know, that but I was a disappointment to myself. I just, you know, I could get a job, I just couldn't do the job. Small flaw. I don't know why that should be that important. You'd think that interviewing skills would count for something, you know, but they actually want you to do the job, wouldn't you get it? And, you know, and I thought, now I've got the answer. I mean, the deal is that I'm an alcoholic. And alcoholism isn't just drinking. It's also psychological and a spiritual and a mental. And now that I'm in AA, and now that I found out that AA has the answer for my problem, I've got about 6 or 7 other things that are going on in my life that should be helped or removed by AA. Now, the problems I had were horrible but ordinary. I couldn't get up in the morning, which is troublesome if you work. It is. I later found out it has something to do with when you go to bed. I just want to report that to you. I throw that in there just in case someone's having some difficulty with that. And then once I got to work, I didn't know what to do when I got to work, which is also a difficulty. I had a financial problem. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made. If you do that over a long period of time, you end up in debt. I want to report that to you. Newly married, started to have some marital issues. Linda and I, you know, two people walk into that union with different expectations. Her dad was a wonderful guy and home every night at 5 o'clock. And I'm, you know, now that I'm sober, I come home, well, fairly often at 5 o'clock. And she'd broil something because all she could do was broil. And we'd have something that we'd broil something. Then I'd go to the meeting, and I'd come home at midnight. Now, she's a RN. She's a nurse. She has to get up at 6, so she's in bed. We were seeing less of each other married than when I was new and active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's getting irritated because she's starting to ask me, I think, questions that she shouldn't ask me. Like, isn't one of the places you should be practicing the principles of the program is in our home? I thought, none of your business. You have your program. She should be grateful. She should be grateful that I'm sober. But we're getting into conflict. She thinks I'm far too active in AA. We start to have kids. I had wonderful parents, but even wonderful parents make mistakes. I wasn't going to make the mistakes that my parents did, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes my parents made and a whole bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that, but that is an accurate description of what I was. And I had a gambling problem. More of a hobby. 3 or 4 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. So I was making about 10 grand a year playing backgammon, and it seemed like a second job. Actually, see, I was kind of proud of it myself. And these problems were not annual problems or quarterly problems. These were daily problems. And, you know, interestingly enough, I had all these problems in my first year of sobriety, and I never noticed them. I was on a honeymoon for my first year. I came in. I remember my first fifth step had wasn't very insightful. My first fifth step just kind of included most of the horrible things that I had done. It was not, it was not, as I say, very insightful for me, but it was the best at that point in time that I could do, and I wouldn't go back and redo that fifth step for all the tea in China. But little by little, as I started through my early recovery, the first thing I did when I came into AA, you know, I had a wall built around me to protect me so that you couldn't see the things that I didn't want you to see. And the thinking that went on behind the wall said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me, because I hate me. And who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me. I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outside. Now, the only way you come out behind that wall is second best. You're just comparing yourself. There's no salvation in that particular situation. But at some point in time behind the wall, I got sick enough, tired enough, afraid enough that I started to tear that wall down. I started to tear it down when I called AA. I continued to tear it down in conversations with my sponsor, and I tore it all the way down when I took my fist up. Clancy used to say, if there was ever a flag that we could all pledge our allegiance to, the flag would say, but I'm different. Okay. Most of us come into this fellowship, both Al-Anon and AA, with a sense of uniqueness that is profound. If you don't drop some of that sense of uniqueness, we often don't stay because you don't think what worked in my life will work in your life. You have to drop it enough to be able to find out, you know, identify. When I tore the wall down, I made the discoveries I'm not unique, but my personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my feelings, not my experience. And I started to have a sense of hope that what worked in your life could work in mine. And for the next 9 or 10 months, I was just in heaven. I was so excited about what I was learning in Alcoholics Anonymous, so excited about the steps, so excited about the prospect that I could change my life. And then what happened to me, as I seemed to go forward in my sobriety, is I started to run into my ongoing defects of character. So I'd be sober 6, 8, 9, 10 months, and I'd say, thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my employment. Put a brick up. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my sex life. Put a brick up. Stay out of my marriage. Put a brick up. Stay out of my parenting. Put a brick up. Stay out of my finances. Stay out of my gambling. You know, brick by brick, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I built my wall back up. And I did it slowly. Do you know what I thought recovery was? I thought recovery was the absence of problems. Now, no one told me that. But I, in my confusion or wisdom or lack of wisdom or whatever the heck it was, that's what I, because I thought if you were a good Christian, you did not sin. I thought being a good person of God was a person who didn't do things wrong. I thought being sober was a person who had it together who didn't have problems. I so admired my sponsor. Now, you got to be stupid. I'm in meetings, discussion meetings, listening to people talk about their lives all the time. They're talking about problems, but I must have a different standard for you than I have for me. I can't explain that, but I think that's what I did have. It was harder on me than it was on you. And when I started to have issues in sobriety that I didn't think I should have, I didn't want to disappoint you, and I didn't want to come clean, so I started to cover them up. I was telling my sponsor about 65 or 70% of what was going on. Now, I know in Vancouver you go 100%. Bill explained that to me, and I think that's admirable. But Minnesota, 60 to 70% is about all people tell their sponsor. And I didn't want to disappoint Warren. People thought I was doing great. I was the youngest guy in our group for 2 years. Everybody's patting me on the head, telling me what a good job I'm doing, and I don't want them to know that I'm not doing a good job. And I got problems at work, at home, money, just everywhere, you know, and so I'm starting to cover them up. By the end of my second year, I had a pretty good list of these defects of character, and they bothered me. I started to grab them one by one, and my idea was, okay, you get me sober, and I'll learn how to work. You get me sober, I'll be a parent. You get me sober, I'll be a husband. You get me sober, I'll handle the game. I did not know how to handle these things. One by one, I tried to deal with these issues, seriously try to deal with them, and I'd fail all the time. Not some of the time, all the time. In my third and fourth year, they bothered me. In my fifth year, they started to eat my lunch. In my seventh and eighth year, I am in a great deal of pain. I am about in the same mental condition I was when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I am unhappy with myself. I'm starting to feel like maybe I got to leave AA and go to... If I had to go to a meeting for every problem I had, I would have been a busy little guy. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, what am I supposed to do? You know, how am I supposed to deal with these things? It's not working, you know. My sponsees are making more progress than I'm making. I mean, I'm at the meeting. New guy comes in, I get him a cup of coffee, shares that bushel basket full of manure that he's got, and I'm saying, hey, God, I'm glad you're here. Just, you're in the right place. Get a cup of coffee, sit down. If you hang out here and just try your best, go to meetings, read the book, and get a sponsor, and try to put those steps in your life, it's going to be okay. See that guy over there? God, his life was an absolute mess, and now he's just knocking it out of the park. You're in the right place. Now I get home, and I get in my car and I drive home 11 o'clock at night and I say, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? You're 7 years sober and you don't know how to work. I don't think you have a pass. I mean, almost everybody knows how to work. What the hell is wrong with you? You have trouble being a parent. When are you going to change that? You got issues with money. When are you going to change it? You just bought a $300 sport coat at a store to get a $400 bill at today. When are you going to stop doing that? And I didn't know, because I had been trying to not do that for a heck of a long time and wasn't able to not do it. My usual relationship with temptation is to give in. Everybody has a relationship. That's my relationship. And I'll tell you, at 7 or 8 years of sobriety, I had lost, I started to lose hope. I really thought, you know, I was always a great starter and always a poor finisher. And I thought, here you are again, Tiger, you know. You got the job, you interview well, but you just can't do the job. And you're sober 7 or 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it works for other people, but it ain't working for you. And I really didn't know what to do. And I knew what the answer was. You know, one of the things that has saved my bacon in AA is my sponsor in old-timers. I love old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had great models and teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the reasons I love the wisdom in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the answer was to develop a deeper and stronger relationship with the God of my understanding. I knew that was the answer. The problem is the moment I go to develop that relationship, what do you think God's going to want me to do? He's going to want me to quit gambling. I think. He's going to want me to get up in the morning. He's going to want me to go to work. I'm pretty sure he's going to want me to stay at work. I also think he wants me to spend about the same amount of money that I make and to be loving and kind to my wife and children. What's the use of developing a relationship with a power that you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? I felt that I knew what God was wanting, you know... I felt I knew what God was going to want me to do, and it was what I had been trying to do for the last 3 or 4 years very hard and was unable to do. My idea was, you know, as soon as I stop doing those things, I'll develop a relationship with God that's deeper and better. But what the hell, I can't right now. It's just dumb to develop the relationship because I'm not going to be able to do what he's going to want me to do. And I was stuck in that place for almost 2 years. Finally, out of desperation, I went back to the steps. Not like I had left them, but I went back with a desperation that I hadn't had for some time. I went back and I took a look at step one, what it meant to me 8 years sober. It wasn't very hard to take a look at the powerlessness and unmanageability in my life. What surprised the heck out of me was step two. I believe step two, for I could put my hand on a lie detector and said, you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? And I'd say yes, and the needle would not move at all. But if you would have asked me at 8 years of sobriety if I believed God was going to restore Bob Bazan to sanity, the answer was no, because I'm 8 years sober and I'm on the down escalator walking up, and every time I take a breath, I go backwards, and it's not working. I'm in as much debt at 8 years of sobriety and as much trouble at 8 years of sobriety as I was when I came in, and I'm scared to death. And so I had to find, I had to reclaim step two for myself. And I, when you're in trouble, you either get more active or less active. All of a sudden, I started to see people around me with smiles on their faces and courage walking through problems that I was trying to walk around. And I came to believe that God was going to restore Bob to sanity. I took step three on my knee with my sponsor in his office. We hadn't done that much around our country. But I didn't want to miss anything this time. I really wanted to do the deal. I did a four step with my third four step, and when I went to my fifth step, I'd done my previous two with clergy, and I decided to do this one with my sponsor, and I said, be careful when you're done, because I'm going to do whatever you recommend to me. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I feel like there's a plastic wall between me and the water. I know where the water is. I know I need the water. I just can't drink, and I'm dying. And I took my fifth step with him, and one of the things he wanted me to do when we were done, we talked a little bit, cried a little bit, and he wanted me to go to an industrial psychologist. I have a lot of problems around work and not work, and around money and success and failure. My father was a successful man. I always thought, I'll never be as good as my father. Why try? You know, I don't know what. Just stuff. And I didn't want to go to a psychologist. It seemed like an admission of failure in my program, but I promised him I would. I did. And I went to the psychologist, and he said, well, can you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been over-involved in my life. If I don't want to get them involved. You can't help me. Could you refer me to someone who could? He said, will you get your wife involved? I thought, oh, crap. You know, when you get your wife involved, you get a whole different data bank and a whole... they just see things so differently. I mean, I thought it would confuse the thing, and he didn't. And so I said, yes, I'll get Linda involved. And he said, well, you get the kids involved. I thought, well, they're pretty young, but yeah, I guess if I have to. And I can remember the meeting. And my business was going broke. And I don't know why. I was working a couple hours a day. And what wasn't going well. And I remember, and I'm literally on the verge of filing bankruptcy with this business, and the psychologist looked at me and he said, why are you so afraid of failure? And my first reaction was to punch him in the mouth. The scouts on it. And I looked at him and I said, look, you jerk. I said, you're a doctor. I said, you know, when you fail, I said, you know, you just take your little sign, move down the hall, put it on a different door, and you're making $100,000 again. I said, I'm about to lose everything I have. When I go down, they're going to publish my name in the paper, I'm going to lose my business, and I'm going to lose, read my lips, everything I have. And he looked over at my wife, and he said, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? Linda said, nope, wouldn't lose me. He looked at my kids, and he's Billy and Peter, and he said, if your father lost everything he had, would he lose you? And the kids said, hell no. You know, if you can't lose, you can't play. I was the guy on the football team who had a uniform. I did the calisthenics. I did the exercises. I did the locker room. But when they blew the whistle to block and tackle, I went up in the stands because I don't block and tackle. Great starter, poor finisher. I never finish anything. If you would have asked me at that point in time in my sobriety what my biggest issue was, I would have said anger. It was in those meetings that I discovered that my biggest issue was fear. And I had taken three previous inventories, and fear was not a major item on my inventory. Anger was, but not fear. And anger was my response to fear in my life. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of being a father. I was afraid of the responsibility of being a husband. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. Of everything. I didn't know. And wasn't dealing with it. And profound discovery at a place that I didn't want to go. Leave the psychologist. I'm home one night. One of the worst nights I've ever had in AA. I went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game, won $600, you know, missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, came home, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. One of those days you'd like to have a videotape that's sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do for you. You know, just... And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, what do you mean it happened again? Isn't it your life? And I said, well, yeah, it's my life, but it's so habitual. It's so automatic. It's almost like I don't even have to think about it. And it's like I'm in a blackout. And all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. You know, there's a power in truth. I believe that when I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous and took the first step, I stood naked in front of my alcoholism and saw it in a way that I had never seen it before, and standing in front of the truth of my alcoholism altered me. Such is the power of truth. That night I realized, I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. I was a guy who wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble, and not have problems because of gambling. I wanted money without work. I wanted my wife's and children's affection without spending time with them. Not a very good design. And all of a sudden I realized that night that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to deal with those issues, and I had failed, and for some reason I was given the grace to understand that that was okay, and I was where I was supposed to be, and I was given the opportunity to take the sixth and the seventh step of AA. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God, not me, remove our defects of character, and seven, humbly ask and remove our shortcomings. I have spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I do not have the power to get rid of my defects of character. I'm responsible for them. I'm in the game. It happens through me, but I am the pipe. I am not the well. And that night, out of fear of getting drunk, but mostly out of fear of being a sober ass, which is what I was. Linda and I have three boys in recovery. Had I not been able to deal with the issues that I'm telling you right now, wouldn't it be wonderful for Mr. AA Speaker to have a kid with alcoholism who didn't want to come to the solution in Alcoholics Anonymous because of what a horse's ass his father was? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't it be wonderful that I get great AA talks? And that happened in my home. Okay? Not cool. So I got down on my knees, I took the sixth and the seventh step, and that day five of the major issues in my life disappeared. Such is the power of God, and such is the power of the program and the sixth and the seventh step. We don't change. God, you know, a farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed, plants a seed in a fertile environment, creates an atmosphere, and a growth can take place, and God grows. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an atmosphere, an aseptic atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place and God changes us. I believe it's the attitude involved in those two steps and the three requirements of being honest, open-minded, and being willing. I had spent the first 8 years in AA trying to get rid of my defects of character, and I had to run out of myself. I do not believe that my experience is unique. I believe that I sponsor maybe 30 guys, and I sponsored an awful lot of men over a long period of time. It is my experience that most people somewhere between 5 and 12 years of sobriety have their rear ends fall off. And it is not necessarily because they are doing a bad job. I believe it is actually because in some ways that we are progressing. I believe that most of us walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and somehow define what we think recovery is. Get my car back, get the heat off, get things calmed down, get a decent job. And many of us accomplish those things in the first couple of years of our sobriety, and we think we're home free and we kind of rest or get on a plateau and everything's going okay. But what happens is that we have, you know, our alcoholism, I believe, in a funny sort of way, goes underground. And it starts to express itself, the same characteristics express itself in our sobriety in different areas, with money, with sex, with anger, with food, with work, or lack of... I don't know anybody who doesn't have at least one significant issue. Some of us have two. I was a generalist. I had three or four. Okay. But I know no one who has none. And as you start to get well, what happens is the program helps us get more honest. Our ability to stuff these things becomes less. They become more prominent, and it is actually the process of going forward in our recovery that presses us against these problems. It looks like we're going backwards, but in effect we are going forwards towards what we have to handle in our recovery, and you can't handle everything in the first couple of years, and many of us are just scared to death to handle some of the ongoing issues. And we deal with them the same way we have historically dealt with them. We deal with them with denial, with lying, covering up, not telling people. We feel ashamed about them. We have the same patterns of dealing with some of the problems in our sobriety as we did in our drinking. And I say that they are not, and you know, it used to seem like when you hear people give an AA talk, they talk about, then I got sober and everything was okay. And I don't want to be the guy that stands up here and says, then I got sober and it was horrible, because it has not been horrible. But the fact is, it has been life. Recovery is not the absence of problems. It is the ability to deal with the problems. And as you go forward, I think in some ways it takes increasing courage, because you're getting kind of closer to the core of the things that are difficult for you to deal with. You're dealing with some of the most serious, persistent character flaws that we have to deal with to find what John talked about. Is you have to have those promises come true in your life sober, or you are not going to stay sober. You have to find in recovery what we were looking for in a bottle. Recovery is not the absence of drinking. Recovery is recovering your life. Many of us, in the middle of our sobriety, our lives were not sufficient. They were not big enough to light the flame anymore. And we have to enlarge the picture of what our recovery is, start to listen to that internal conversation of the God within. And it's a process of coming home. It's a process. It's a trip. It is really a trip. That night, you know, when you're serious about that night, I said the truth will change you. That night, I stood naked in front of my life and saw it for what it was. And the truth altered me again, and I had another spiritual experience at 8 years of sobriety. My life took off like a rocket ship, and for the next 10 years, everything I touched turned to gold. When you are serious about making a change, you put a support system in place. I made a deal with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and when I'd come home. I quit gambling that day. I started to date my wife. I dated my wife every Friday night for the last 25 years. When we travel, it's a different night if I'm not giving an AA talk or something like that. But I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's love and affection. I had to learn how to go back and be with my wife romantically. I had to go back and learn how to be in a way that was attractive enough that we, you know, go shack up for a weekend someplace. Go have some fun. We were just talking about kids and money and problems all the time. I mean, we had to get together in a way that was attractive for us to recover. I have spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you got. It is just a big job. I mean, it is just, it is such a wonderful job. It is such a blessing, and yet it is, maintaining a lifetime relationship, as I said, with these things is just a big job. And in that period of time, my life, it was just extraordinary. It was just like someone lit a booster rocket. All of a sudden, the guy who couldn't work could work. I was also lucky enough that I was in the real estate investment business. It was at a real good time to be in that business, and just, everything turned to gold. Later, 10 years later, I lost it all. Then I had the real estate collapse of... I lost $8 million in 3 years. They had, I was faced again with bankruptcy. My wife's back. We're talking about budgets. I think budget is an Al-Anon word. I do not think it's a word that I can understand about why. It's a harsh word, I think, for alcoholics. It just, I don't know what it is. It just sends terror up my spine. I'm 22 years sober, and I was losing everything I had. Our middle child had just come home from college out in Denver and got arrested for drunken driving, totaled on an automobile, and ended up in detox. It was his Christmas present to his mother and I. And he goes to treatment. I'm going to the halfway house with Linda on Friday nights to go to the meeting. I'm crying through the whole meeting. I mean, just the meeting starts, I'm in tears. I'm depressed. I'm losing. I'm under my desk sucking my thumb. It's just, you know, I mean, it could not be worse. Could not be worse. I'm, you know, got a big house paid for, lose the house, you know, got to go. And, you know, I just could see those people to me. See that guy over there? He's got 22. I'd like to have what he has. You know, just, Vicky's got the clap. I don't know what the hell. I just, you know. And once again, I think when you're in trouble, you're either more active or less active, and I got more active. And I believe that the universe is trying to teach me a lesson. I don't think the universe had a real estate collapse to teach it personally to me. But I think within every major issue you have in your life, there is always a lesson for you to learn. And I think I had to learn who I was without my money. I think there are problems with lack of success, and I think there are problems with success. I developed an arrogance in my success that I didn't know I had. I thought God was blessing me because I was such a wonderful member of AA. How would you like to have gone to meetings with me? And but mostly what I want to say is I think life's a journey. I think if you're going to stay sober for 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 years, you're going to run into illnesses and deaths and business issues and issues with your children and issues with your marriage and issues with life. I don't think we're immune to them. But if you have a program and if you have principles, if a relationship with a higher power, you will have tools to deal with them better than you could ever imagine. And they are resolvable. And the program that we have is not just a program for not drinking. It's a program for living. It works on marriages. It works on families. It works on sex. It works on money. It works on life. It works on everything because it is true. It is of God. It is just, isn't it wonderful that we are forced to find a way to live that allows our lives to be better than they would have been had we never had the disease. I mean, it is, you know, you hear people say that I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. When you first hear that, we're confused by what it is. As I end my talk, I want to, you know, one of my mentors, a guy by the name of Bob White, who's dead many years, said, I hate giving AA talks now. I no longer enjoy giving AA talks as much as I used to. It used to be one of the big thrills of my life, and I still do it, but I'm not. It isn't quite as much fun. This has been fun this weekend. It has been nice. 2 weeks ago, I gave an AA talk, and it was one of the worst AA talks I ever gave. I don't know why. But, you know, you give 100 talks, you're going to have a couple of them that you just don't feel very good about. And when you do that, once in a while, you figure, geez, you know, why don't you stop giving talks? Or, you know, and, but I do it because I'm asked. I don't do it as I have a deal with my wife. I do one a month. I get asked a lot, and I don't, you know, I figure there are so many wonderful talkers today, and I think also that your family gets to be an AA request too, you know, so you need a little balance in your life, and everybody deals with that differently. There are people who think every time you're asked to go, and God bless them. I think people like Chamberlain and Clancy and different people I have been the benefactor of their unbalanced contribution to me. I do not mean that as a criticism. I'm just saying what those men have devoted to the fellowship is extraordinary, and you know, everybody makes, you have to find your own place. You have to trust your own heart. You have to listen to your own internal conversation, and it's going to be different for everybody. There isn't one right way to do it. There is not, you know, Billy Graham is not a balanced guy, you know. I do not mean that as you're getting trouble. No, but I mean, he's a devoted man who spends his entire life, you know, in his ministry. And we have people who do that too. But God used to say to me, one of the reasons I do that, he said, one of the things that keeps it alive for me is, he says, you get on themes. You get on stuff that you want to talk about, and after you get sober about 30 years, go ahead and talk about it. So I got something that I want to talk about, and I'm going to talk about it. One of the great, remember how I told you early on in my sobriety, I discovered how fear was a major issue for me, and I didn't even know it. And one of the discoveries I made in the last 10 years, I really think that there are an awful lot of people who sit in an audience like this that have somewhere between 1 and 25 to 30 years of sobriety that are having serious issues in their lives, and right now, today, they're not as optimistic about changing and healing some of those areas as they were when they first maybe came into fellowship. And I have been in audiences listening to talks and crying and wondering when it was going to be okay for me. And I think if I ask people in the audience to raise their hands and say, how many of you would like to get rid of the things that is harming your life and harming the important people in your life? I think almost all of us would raise our hands. We'd say, yeah, I'm up for it. I want to get rid of the stuff that doesn't work, especially the stuff that's hurting the other people in my life. I want to change. Well, I got news for you. That's not true. It's true in one way, but it's not true in another, and I'm going to talk about that for a minute. We are so afraid of change. It is just mind-boggling. Okay? Scott Peck wrote a book, Road Less Traveled. Later on, he wrote another book further along, A Road Less Traveled. There's a chapter in that book called The Road to Omaha. And in that, it's about death and dying. We talk about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of death and dying: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. He talked about, you know, you got cancer, and denial, well, maybe I don't have cancer, get a second opinion, you know. Anger, you know, why is this happening to me, you know. Bargaining, God, please take this away, I'll go to China. You know, depression, when you go through those first three stages and you get up against the reality of the situation, you get your nose pressed into it, and you go into depression. And if you get through the depression, you run into acceptance. Scott Peck said that when people hear about the phrase the five stages of death and dying, they assume that most people go through all five stages. They don't. They go through the denial and the anger and the bargaining, but they get to the depression, and the pain of the depression is too great, and they back off and go recycle into denial, anger, and bargaining. What he said is, interestingly enough, this is the stages that people go through when they're dealing with difficult problems of change in their life. We deal with change like death. Okay? Most of us do not want an answer. If God were to, you know, the big book's got the columns for the fourth, step and that stuff. Pretend, I got guys today, I'm saying, hey, that's kind of complicated. You know, I said, you want to do a fourth step and a fifth step? I got a cool way to do this now. It's modern, much more beneficial to you. I know you're having trouble with it. Just get your wife and your mom and dad and your two kids, brother and sister, your boss, co-worker, three creditors, and two neighbors, and bring them over the house. And then serve coffee, and here's what I want you to say. We have a step in AA where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I am having trouble identifying them. And I was wondering if you would help. And then pass out tablets and leave. Now, do you know why we laugh at them? We wouldn't call that meeting. Do you know why we wouldn't call them? We don't want to change. But it's worse than that. We don't want to know. We train each other. We're not going to talk about that. We train our wives. Nod your head up and down if you understand we are not having that discussion. You want to have that discussion? It's going to be a tough discussion. We train our children, what they can say to us, what they can't say to us. You get to a point, you know, I don't know what it is, that you're early on in sobriety, you got a problem, you can try and fail, try and fail, try and fail, try and fail, but you can still grow. But there comes a time in your sobriety where you have to change or you stop growing. It's time to change. And if you pass that time, you start hanging out with people who got the same problem. The chasers hang out with the chasers, gamblers hang out with the gamblers, and you make a deal. I won't call you on your crap, you don't call me on mine. God, we'll talk about the steps, we'll go to meetings, we'll talk about the traditions. You stay out of my face, I'll stay out of yours. Deal? Bad deal. Real bad deal. We are afraid of change. We view it as death. But Scott Peck said in that book, if you go through denial, anger, and bargaining, and you get into the depression, not playing doctor here, not talking about a clinical depression, talking about an appropriate depression due to the circumstances. And he says, but if you allow depression to do its work, which from my own personal experience I can report is to grind the ego to dust. What's the answer? The answer is that Chuck Chamberlain one time went to a conference in Atlanta, the Pittsburgh conference, and he was asked to give a talk. They had most of the experts from around the United States in alcoholism. Chuck very seldom did anything that wasn't pure AA, but he went to that conference. And I remember when he was done with that conference later, it was another convention, someone walked up and said, "How was it, Chuck? What did you think of the experts on alcoholism?" And in Chuck's wisdom, he had a way of succinctly putting his finger sometime in the middle of something, and he said, "They don't know much about surrender." Surrender is the answer. But if you were going to go to someone in pain, how do you tell someone how to surrender? Words do not encompass God in total. You can point to God, you know, but as the masters say, when the master points to the moon, all the idiot sees is the finger. It is, you know, because the answer is in God's wisdom, and the answer is surrender. But you can't, because surrender is spiritual, it is not mechanical. If it was mechanical, all we'd have to do is say the third step prayer, click our heels, and we'd be back in Kansas. There would be no, I'm serious, there would be no issue. If the steps were mechanical, there'd be no issue. But they're spiritual. And because they're spiritual, there is a way of being and taking of the steps that is different than just mechanical. And I do not have the wisdom to be able to use the word. I know that it takes a certain degree of integrity. I know that it takes a certain degree of honesty. I know that it takes a certain degree of humility. And I know in my heart that the program is a change in, you know, what everybody wants to know when they come to me, my sponsees, when they're done, they say, "What should I do?" And mostly what I want to say is, "I don't care." No, not for what, because it isn't about doing. It is about being. It is changing how you be. It is changing how you are. It is changing your heart, because the moment your heart changes, your behavior changes. This is a transformation. This is not just a change. It is not linear. It is far beyond a linear change. It is a change of heart. It is a change of being. And the moment you change your heart, you just automatically change your behavior. And it is the engagement with the 12 steps. It is a relying on a power greater than yourself to gain courage. And it takes a great deal of courage to remain a person in growth. Because most of us want to find a place that's just safe and hang out there. And one of the things, and the last thing I'm going to say, is one of the things that you need, if you're older in sobriety, as you go through, you need to develop the quality of compassion, not only for others, but also for yourself. If you do not have the quality of compassion, you'll be too judgmental. I have spent much of my early life having all the answers and being too judgmental. If you're too judgmental, you will be unable to look at the faults that you have, because you will be too harsh on yourself. You have to be gentle enough with yourself to be able to take a look at them and stand in front of them, because it is only being able to be with them. The things you can't be with own you. The things you can be with, you can manage. And you can get help. Thank you very much for having me here this weekend. I love all of you.